listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Event Cascade by Anthony Bresnahan. Thell stated, "This ammunition was not factory rounds, the search warrant document declares. In other words, they were homemade, and Starline Brass supplies the materials for such things." After the training session, Thell Reed said Kinney kept that extra canister. "Those rounds, we believe, were the ones that ended up on the set," says Jason Bowles, an attorney for Gutierrez Reed. "So the Reeds are conceding that the bullet that killed Hutchins may once have belonged to them, but contend it was brought to the Rust production by Kinney." In early January, Gutierrez Reed filed a lawsuit against Kinney, formalizing these allegations. Thell Reed's claim is being investigated, but there is skepticism that it may be an effort to generate doubt. Carmack Altwies declined to say what may have been found in either party's possession. In her lawsuit, Gutierrez Reed even claims Kinney warned her that dragging me into this would backfire. If anything, the DA may perceive this as an unapologetic scapegoat tactic and lower the boom even harder, he wrote on November 20th, according to screenshots included in the filing. Kinney declined to be interviewed for this story. Calls placed to PDQ headquarters in Lake Havasu, Arizona, were not answered. A text sent to a cell phone listed under Kinney's name received the following reply: "This is fake news. I don't see any credibility in your organization." In December, Kinney told Good Morning America his company individually rattle test such each dummy to ensure no live rounds are sent to a set. "It's not a possibility that they came from PDQ or from myself personally," he said. Gutierrez Reed's lawsuit against Kinney suggests he urged her to shift the blame to Rust assistant director. "Go and talk to the police. Tell them everything, answer every question, down to what you had for breakfast," he wrote in November, according to another screenshot included in the claim. "You're young. Certainly not green or inexperienced with period weapons. But did you get rolled over by the set system and the AD with 30-plus years of experience? I think you did, and you're too proud to say that." 3. Loading the bullet. As the prop assistant and armorer, Gutierrez Reed was responsible for prepping the vintage Colt 45 that Baldwin held during that fatal rehearsal. There is little to no dispute about that. As a result, she has been vilified more than any other individual involved. But her attorney insists she was a conscientious worker, overwhelmed by the demands and chaos of a poorly run set. Though Gutierrez Reed told the Voices of the West podcast that her one previous job had gone smoothly, the key grip on the old way, Stu Brambaugh, remembers the production differently. "I didn't get the sense that she was careless. I got the sense that she was inexperienced. And there's a big difference," he says. Brambaugh felt Gutierrez Reed lacked training in set protocols and recalled a moment with one of the horse wranglers. They were having a discussion about a certain horse possibly being spooked at the sound of the gun going off, he says. "She was testing, so she kind of fired at the ground near the horse. However the horse reacted, the crew freaked, Nobody likes a gun going off behind them when it's unannounced, he said. Amid the uproar, he remembered Gutierrez Reed acknowledging the mistake. I think she kind of recognized, like, oh yeah, oh shit, yeah. But then it happened again. Days later, Brumbaugh says she was talking with someone about the differences between blanks, full rounds, half rounds, and quarter rounds, which refers to the amount of explosive powder in each. The more powder, the bigger the bang. To demonstrate, she fired at the ground again, he said. Then I was pissed. At that point, I was like, okay, this is the second time in like 3 days that this has happened, Brumbaugh says. And when she did that, unfortunately for her, Nick Cage was walking by, and he grabbed his ear, and he kind of chewed her out. He kind of bit into her because he was pretty pissed off. Experience cost money, and producers like to cut cost, which Brumbaugh believes is causing safety issues throughout the industry. Young crew workers don't always have the backbone to resist when filmmakers demand too much. So you have a 20-something who's being hounded by the AD to hurry, to rush, to go, 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 go. We need the shot. The actor's on set. You're trying to do a million different things. And when you're young, you're not efficient. That's exactly what Gutierrez Reed's attorney believes happened to her that day on Rust, although he disagrees with the assessment that she was inexperienced. In the late morning on October 21st, Gutierrez Reed and the other prop workers began prepping the guns, including Baldwin's Colt 45. The actor needed it for a rehearsal set to begin before lunch. Approximately 11 a.m., Hannah has loaded 5 dummies. They were clearly dummies, says Bowles, Gutierrez Reed's lawyer, adding that his client had shaken every one of them to check. The 6th round would not go in, so she left it with 5. She handed that over to Baldwin. They did a brief thing, and then they broke for lunch. At that point, Bowles says the gun went back to Gutierrez Reed, who locked it in the prop truck safe. After lunch, around 1 p.m., she went to retrieve it and fix that empty 6th slot. Dummies are necessary because the ends of the revolver's cylinder are exposed, and viewers would be able to tell if the chambers were empty. So she cleans the cylinder, and she pulls another round, a different round, out of that box and puts that round into the chamber, Bowles says. At the same time, he says she was being urgently summoned to set over her radio. Did she shake that last round to make sure it was a dummy? Yes, her attorney says. She thought it had rattled, but at the same time, people are screaming in her earpiece, get the gun, get the gun. But she thought it had rattled. At some point, a real bullet made its way into that gun. So was that last round the one that killed Helena Hutchins? We don't know for sure, because that gun was out of her eyesight and custody for 15 minutes, Bowles says, referring to when Gutierrez Reed handed the gun over for the rehearsal moments later and left the church. But if indeed nobody else had access to it, then, yes, that would have been the round, the live round. In many media reports, Gutierrez Reed has been depicted as carrying multiple guns simultaneously in a dangerous manner, sometimes wedged under her arms. Bowles says this is a misrepresentation. It wasn't that she was inexperienced. It was that production had her doing 2 different jobs, Bowles says. She fought for a week and a half trying to get a cart, and people are bitching about her carrying the guns under her arms. Well, she didn't have a cart to put them on. He shared screenshots in which she was actually praised by director Souza for her diligence. Excellent work today, Souza texted her on October 8th. Always quick with the weapons and quick with the ammo and very safe. Days before Hutchins' death, Gutierrez Reed was reprimanded by a manager for spending too much time on weaponry. "We hired you as both armor and key assistant props," wrote line producer Gabrielle Pickle on October 14th. "However, it has been brought to my attention that you are focusing far more on armor and not supporting props as needed." Gutierrez Reed was receiving mixed messages. In the same exchange, Pickle described two incidents in which a shotgun was found unattended and requested that a check-in procedure be put in place immediately that would keep firearms locked away when not in use. Gutierrez Reed wrote back that a check-in system would slow the production and said she had repeatedly warned actors in safety meetings not to abandon weapons. "An actor will set them somewhere and forget them, and that's just a thing that happens, same as every other prop," Gutierrez Reed told the line producer. "Even days when we aren't doing gunfire, I'm still doing the armorer job, checking the guns in for every single scene and showing they're empty. So when guns are left by an actor, we at least know that they are a clear gun." Pickle pressed her again about committing to the other prop work. "Well, Gabby, I think I have been taking my prop side seriously," Gutierrez Reed wrote back. In another email exchange on October 14th, with a crew member named TC, Gutierrez Reed addressed the safety procedures surrounding the use of blanks by referencing another famous film set tragedy. She invoked The Crow from 1993, when a broken fragment of a dummy round was launched out of the barrel of a prop gun by a blank cartridge, killing the film's 28-year-old star. "As armorer, it's my job to be present when all actors fire," Gutierrez Reed wrote. "Misfires haven't happened on any of my sets. I always check barrels. R.I.P. Brandon Lee." 4. Lax on-set safety inspection. Matters of life and death on set are never just one person's responsibility. After Lee's death on The Crow, investigators chose not to prosecute any of the crew, saying the negligence that caused the accident was not willful or wanton. But after that, checking for loose fragments in prop guns and verifying for everyone within the vicinity whether a gun was full of dummies, cold, or loaded with blanks, hot, became far more vigorous. Armorers typically perform such public inspections, but assistant directors do too, or they supervise. Often they remove and inspect each fake bullet, rattling the dummies and ensuring no possible projectiles are in front of the blanks. But nothing that painstaking happened on the set of Rust. After cleaning the cylinder to make the sixth round fit, Gutierrez Reed hurried the Colt 45 to the weathered wooden church set, her attorney says, and presented it to Assistant Director Dave Halls. She then spins the cylinder for him, showing him it's got six rounds in it, and hands it to him. He said, "Okay." She then leaves the church. She did not take them out and shake them again for Halls, Bowles adds, but she had done that before lunch. Of course, that was before she added the final round. It was a punishing day on set. Work began before dawn, around 6:30 a.m., which was common for the production. Hutchins had posted a photo to her Instagram 2 weeks before her death, showing a sunrise that glowed like wildfire. "One of the best parts of shooting a Western are mornings like this," she wrote. But on the morning of the 21st, the dispute over working conditions and hotel accommodations had reached a breaking point, and some of the camera operators walked off the set, leaving the production scrambling and short-staffed. Sousa later told sheriff's investigators that they'd only scraped together enough replacement workers to run one camera instead of several at once, which slowed everything down. Midway through the production, the movie was in crisis. During the lunch break, Assistant Director Halls got into a dispute with script supervisor Mamie Mitchell, who later angrily recounted their fight in her 911 call to report the shooting. Then came the post-lunch rehearsal. Baldwin was working with Sousa and Hutchins on a shot that would see his outlaw character rise from a church pew and exchange fire with some armed men hunting for him and his grandson. A report from the sheriff's office said Baldwin was practicing a cross draw, reaching across his body with one hand to pull the firearm from a holster. Here, Halls and Gutierrez Reed's accounts diverge. Her attorney says she handed the weapon to Halls and left the church. In her lawsuit against PDQ, she states that Baldwin wasn't even in the church. However, Hall's attorney, Lisa Taracco, says Gutierrez Reed handed the weapon directly to the actor. The sheriff's report says crew members saw Halls hand the gun to the actor. As the assistant director, Dave Halls, handed the prop gun to actor Alec Baldwin, Dave Halls yelled, "Cold gun," indicating the prop gun did not have any live rounds, stated an October 22nd search warrant affidavit. Hall's attorney contends that the investigator's document is riddled with inaccuracies. "I think some of the witnesses got confused when they said that they thought that Halls handed it to Baldwin, because at one point, Baldwin needs to readjust his holster, and he hands the firearm to Mr. Halls, who's standing 3 feet next to him on set. Then Baldwin took the gun back," she says. Did Halls call out cold gun, as witnesses said? His attorney says Halls isn't sure. He doesn't have a memory of that. After the shooting, some former colleagues of Halls came forward to complain to the media about his work on past films. Maggie Gall, a prop maker who worked with him on the Hulu series Into the Dark in 2019, told CNN in a statement that he had to be reminded to make safety announcements. The Associated Press, citing an anonymous producer, said Halls was fired from the drama Freedom's Path that same year after an accidental gun discharge hurt the ears of a sound technician. Neither Gall nor producers for Freedom's Path responded to requests for comment from Vanity Fair. Hall's attorney declined to comment on those claims. Taracco does admit that, on the set of Rust, Gutierrez Reed opened the gun and showed it to Halls upon her arrival in the church. He did examine the gun, but he didn't even hold it when he was examining it, she says. He remembers the chambers only being partially full, with 3 or maybe 4 rounds, she added. Halls did not remove the rounds or shake them. He was told that that's the armorer's responsibility, says Taracco. He wasn't distracted, and he wasn't under duress, and he didn't overlook anything. He did his job the way he was told and taught to do his job. He relied on other people to do their job because they're professionals as well. Baldwin would later say roughly the same thing about himself. 5. The gun goes off. The scene in question was never filmed. Sheriff Mendoza says no cameras were rolling when the shooting occurred. Baldwin was only working with Hutchins to figure out camera angles when the unthinkable occurred. Here is the sequence from page 87 of Rust's 101-page screenplay that was being rehearsed. Alec Baldwin's wounded gunslinger has taken refuge in a weather-beaten prairie chapel, blood pooling beneath his pew. 2 men enter from the back of the church, urging him to surrender. "Rust is still," the script reads, hand moving almost unnoticeably, slips a Colt from its holster. "Ain't no iteration you walk out of this church lessen you stand up slow and toss them guns," one of the men calls out. Rust Colt cocked quietly now. Gunfire from afar causes the men to whirl, giving Rust the distraction he needs to strike. Colts exploding, shredding the pew in front of him, the script continues. Rust hits the floor, rolling under pews. Out the other side, staggering up, Colts barking, Rust moving backwards, unrelenting fire, makes it out a door. Should Baldwin himself have checked the gun? George Clooney is among the actors who say he should have. Every single time I'm handed a gun on the set, every time they hand me a gun, I look at it, I open it, I show it to the person I'm pointing it to, I show it to the crew, Clooney said on Mark Maron's WTF podcast, every single take. In a December interview with ABC News, Baldwin reacted testily to the notion that he bore some responsibility. If your protocol is you checking the gun every time, well, good for you. Good for you, he said. My protocol was to trust the person that had the job, and it worked up until this point. He said he felt haunted by what happened, but did not feel guilty. No? No, I might have killed myself if I thought I was responsible, and I don't say that lightly. Baldwin, who declined to be interviewed for this story, also dismissed the suggestion that he might bear some responsibility for the way the set operated, though he, his production company, and his manager were among Rust producers, and he was credited with co-creating the story with Sousa. I'm not a producer that hires the crew, he said. Finally, there was this bombshell claim in the interview. I didn't pull the trigger. That caught the attention of D.A. Carmack Altwies. I didn't know too much about guns, certainly not about 1850s-era revolvers. So when I first heard that, I was like, oh, that's crazy, she says. Baldwin says that he merely pulled back the hammer on the gun. FBI analysis of the weapon will determine functionality, as well as whether mechanical failures might have caused it to go off. But in the meantime, Carmack Altwies and her investigative team did an unofficial test of their own. One of the investigators in my office happens to have a very old-type revolver, and so he brought it at my request so that we could look at it and see if that was at all possible, she says. They cleared a room in the office, and two investigators inspected the gun, the one who had supplied it, then a second officer who verified that it was empty. Then they visually showed me, says Carmack Altwies. You can pull the hammer back without actually pulling the trigger and without actually locking it. So you pull it back part way. It doesn't lock. And then if you let it go, the firing pin can hit the primer of the bullet. And that can cause a live round of ammunition to fire. What the district attorney does with that information will become clearer as the year progresses. Once all the lab data is complete, once all the claims and counterclaims are investigated, she will reach a decision about whether the failures that killed Helena Hutchins amount to criminal wrongdoing. Among the possible charges are involuntary manslaughter and negligent use of a deadly weapon. To bring either to a jury, she would need proof that those involved knew or should have known they were being unsafe. Baldwin and crew workers who directly handled the gun will undoubtedly be embroiled in civil litigation and workplace investigations for years to come. An OSHA probe began immediately and could result in monetary penalties and perhaps even new safety regulations, and at least two crew workers have sued the producers, their companies, and even other crew members for injury and emotional distress. Hutchins' family has reportedly retained a legal team, but has not yet filed a wrongful death claim. The firm did not respond to a request for comment. But could any of the producers, including Baldwin, or writer-director Sousa, himself one of the victims, be charged with a crime for how the set was managed? Carmack Altwies says their actions would have to be deliberate. That's why investigators sought access to Baldwin's cell phone to see what communication about practices on set were shared between the Rust leadership before the shooting. Certainly, there's a potential for a producer or producers to be charged if we have direct evidence that they willfully disregarded the safety of others, Carmack Altwies says. That's why I keep saying everything's on the table. Nothing will bring Hutchins back. Nothing will heal the loss. But understanding specifically what happened here, cutting through the obfuscation and finger-pointing, could prevent a similar loss from happening again. Before Carmack Altwies brings any charges, she will have one other important meeting. She will sit down with Hutchins' family. The district attorney has not done that yet, on purpose. If they ask me a question, I can't answer it at this point, she says. Once she decides how to move forward, she will solicit their thoughts. In New Mexico, there's a Victims' Rights Act that's part of our Constitution, and they have an absolute right to be at all court hearings, to give their opinions on whether a plea should be offered, and then to speak at sentencing. That will lead the DA back to Hutchins herself. Who was she? What did she love? What did she mean to those who knew and loved her back? I have to know who I'm fighting for, the district attorney says. I know I'm fighting for the constituents in my district, but also this specific victim. At this point, I can't let all of that emotion cloud the judgment that goes into viewing the facts, then deciding if someone should be held criminally liable. We have to go through that procedure, and then I can start to try to get to know the victim in order to convey to a jury what this world has lost.
Thank you.
Through a Glass Darkly by Julie Miller, with interviews by Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick. Jerry Lewis's patented form of slapstick made him a 20th century icon, but former co-stars first interviewed by the directors behind Allen vs. Farrow say he was a bully who sexually harassed and, in at least one case, sexually assaulted women with impunity. A collaboration between Vanity Fair and the filmmakers reveals what happened when the cameras weren't rolling. Opening photo shows Jerry Lewis smoking a cigarette and looking directly into the camera. She'd never been summoned by a co-star like that before, but then she'd never worked with Jerry Lewis. Apparently, it was how he did things. Karen Sharp had already held her own on screen with Clint Eastwood and John Wayne and won a Golden Globe for the airplane disaster movie The High and the Mighty when she was cast in 1964's The Disorderly Orderly. The role, the love interest to Lewis's typically zany buffoon, hadn't initially appealed to her. It was a comedy, and she preferred drama. It had also been made clear she wasn't permitted to be funny opposite the film's notoriously insecure leading man. But Sharp had recently taken a year-and-a-half-long hiatus from Hollywood. She'd gone to San Antonio to settle her father's estate after his death, and returned to a town that seemed to have forgotten about her. When Lewis offered her the role, he even sweetened the deal, tripling her salary, and guaranteeing that Edith Head, the costume designer behind Grace Kelly's and Audrey Hepburn's iconic looks, would create her wardrobe. "It was an offer I shouldn't refuse," says Sharp, now 87. Lewis had the power to make these promises. About a decade earlier, he'd split from Dean Martin after their singing and comedy duo rocketed both to a post-World War II superstardom on par with Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley. Critics and Lewis himself believed the hyperactive comedian, not Martin's straight man crooner, was the real talent. Lewis, who had been the putsy kid brother to Martin's debonair gentleman, felt he had outgrown his partner. Lewis's ego expanded even more in 1959, when, at age 33, he signed a 7-year contract with Paramount for a base of $10 million, the largest contract of its kind between a studio and performer at the time. He could hire whomever he pleased. And Lewis was prolific. In bed, even arriving at the studio early to fit in a little hump before work, he later told GQ. In conception, he had 6 sons with his then-wife Patty, all of whom he left out of his estimated $50 million estate, and in films. The Disorderly Orderly was Lewis's 16th film at Paramount in just 8 years as a solo act. By 1959, his movies, solo and with Martin, had brought in $100 million for Paramount at a time when tickets cost less than 70 cents. He was so untouchable that Paramount's head of production, Barney Balaban, had said, "If Jerry wants to burn down the studio, I'll give him the match." All this to say that when Lewis summoned Sharp to set to see what his leading lady looked like in costume, Sharp might have been surprised. Lewis's longtime collaborator, Frank Tashlin, was actually the director, but it would have been reckless to say no. The movie was being filmed in a mammoth Beverly Hills mansion, which was large enough to look like a hospital, no matter the chandeliers. Sharp reported to Lewis's office, and with a wardrobe mistress standing nearby, began modeling her costumes while Lewis requested various nips and tucks. When Sharp was down to her final costume, Lewis picked up a walkie-talkie and excused the guards outside his office. "Then Lewis started moving in on me," recalls Sharp. "He grabbed me. He began to fondle me. He unzipped his pants. Quite frankly, I was dumbstruck. Sharp protested. I put my hand up and said, "Wait a minute. I don't know if this is a requirement for your leading ladies, but this is something I don't do," she says. I could see that he was furious. I got the feeling that that never really happened to him. Next photo, tangled mess. The star froze out Karen Sharp, seen here with him and the disorderly orderly, after he assaulted her and she pushed back, she says. She tried to politely dismiss the assault without insulting the star. She even offered to quit, concerned it would be awkward to film scenes as romantic partners. But the contract had been signed, Lewis said. The costumes were made, and she was due back for filming in 3 days. When Sharp returned to Greystone Mansion on her start date, a crew member was waiting with a message. According to Sharp, the entire production, save for the director and assistant director, had been told they could not speak to Sharp. "If anyone speaks to you, we'll be fined," the crew member explained apologetically. "I wanted to let you know, but I can't even speak to you." The punishment went further. Before her first scene, Sharp learned that Lewis would not rehearse with her. She could work with Lewis's stand-in, but when the lead arrived, he refused to interact with or acknowledge Sharp unless the camera was rolling. "That happened through the whole film," she says. "He never worked with me. He never spoke to me. The first take of what we did together was what went on film, and that was what everyone was going to see." Sharp could have talked to her manager, but what was he going to do? She knew firsthand how quickly the industry could forget an actor, and feared further retribution for behaving problematically according to the era's antiquated standards. So on screen, she played nice toward the man punishing her, stoically stomaching his shtick. In a scene set at an Italian restaurant, Sharp watches Lewis spiral a forkful of spaghetti until it's wrapped around his entire arm, and then listens as he attempts to teach her a lesson. Respect and admiration, those you have to earn. She was called to set on days she was not filming, but obliged with a smile, reading in her solitary confinement, eating alone in the commissary, and sneaking onto the nearby set of Stanley Kramer's Ship of Fools to watch her idol Vivian Leigh. Kramer noticed her. They were later married for 35 years, until his death. On her final day of production, Sharp was leaving her dressing room when she bumped into Lewis. She thanked him for the pay raise and her beautiful costumes. Lewis interrupted her to say she was a hell of a girl. Then he confessed, "I honestly don't know how you came to work every day." He offered an explanation. "You see, I'm sick." That's when Sharp finally snapped. "Jerry, bullshit. Is that your excuse for bad behavior? That you're sick, and people are supposed to excuse that? Well, I don't excuse that." "It was the most unprofessional leading man, leading lady relationship I've ever had in my 20 years as an actor. Just think how much better we could have been if you'd been professional and cooperated." She had one final thought. "You ever think about playing a heavy, a real son of a bitch?" asked Sharp. "Because you're really good at that. People wouldn't believe it, but we both know that's who you really are." Maybe audiences mistook Lewis for the pratfalling fool he played on screen, all crossed eyes, broad jokes, and desperate attention vying. But many in Hollywood knew he was cantankerous, difficult, and cruel, an insecure egomaniac with an all-consuming sex drive. "I'm a selfish man," admitted Lewis in one interview. He expanded on the theme in 2006's Dean and Me, A Love Story. "When fame and money come all at once, even the strongest men will get their heads turned around. I had plenty of strengths, but avoiding temptation was not one of them." Lewis had a reputation, like many before and after him, that rippled through the industry. But because of his money-making potential and his philanthropy, not to mention Hollywood's history of corrupt morals and misogyny, his behavior was ignored. Next photo, close call. Jerry Lewis came on to Lainey Kazan during a meeting about a potential role, even as he humiliated her and critiqued her body. And she is pictured here. Several years ago, Emmy-winning and Oscar-nominated filmmakers Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering began investigating old Hollywood's long history of abuse. The pair have covered alleged sexual abuse in the church, Twist of Faith, on college campuses, the hunting ground, in the military, the invisible war, and most recently, within one brutally divided family, Allen versus Pharaoh. Around 2017, they began interviewing actors, collecting devastating stories, many of which were shared for the first time. Some of the most explosive accusations involved Jerry Lewis. The filmmakers brought their interviews to Vanity Fair, wanting the women's stories to be heard. Speaking about Hope Holliday, the 91-year-old actor from Billy Wilder's The Apartment, Dick says, "I remember Hope saying she thought she would take these stories to her grave. She never thought anyone would be interested. She never thought there'd be a safe space to tell them." Ziering and Dick also made a short film with some of the women's stories, which can be seen at vf.com/Lewis. People have reported and acted against Hollywood sexual harassment and abuse since 1937, when movie extra Patricia Douglas became the first woman to take on a studio for sexual assault. She claimed she was raped by an MGM salesman after boarding a bus, along with other aspiring starlets who were told they'd be filming on location, only to be deposited at a sales convention as party favors. After filing a lawsuit, her name was smeared by studio fixers, her address leaked to the press, and her case dismissed. The district attorney had been accused of taking MGM bribes. Generations of women kept quiet about sexual assault and harassment, in part because neither they nor the society they lived in had even a vocabulary for it. Longtime star Loretta Young did not realize she had been date-raped by Clark Gable in 1935 until she heard the phrase on CNN 63 years later and asked friends to explain it to her. Once she was clear on the meaning, she said, "That's what happened with me and Clark." The women Ziering spoke to describe an era and town where aggressive sexual overtures and abuse were so ingrained that it was not even something you questioned. This was the state of the industry. It was just something you figured out how to navigate. They were expected to accept being assaulted and to just deal with it themselves, adds Dick, explaining that Hollywood even helped normalize the idea of trading sexual favors for parts by referencing it in film and TV. The casting couch has been treated as a joke for a long time, which is a form of acceptance that sends a message that there's nothing wrong with it and there's no reason to be upset about it or report it. Of course, it's very traumatic, and I think that kind of terminology is also used in the way of seeing them as disposable. In the 1950s, the fan magazine Picturegoer published an expose on casting couch practices. "This is the most depressing story we have ever written," the reporters wrote. "For weeks, we have made our investigations. We have built up a dossier of information which we believe is an ugly scar on the glamorous face of show business. No one noticed the story." In 1953, Marilyn Monroe herself wrote an essay for Motion Picture and Television magazine titled "The Wolves I Have Known," in which she wrote frankly about Hollywood predators. "I met them all. Phoniness and failure were all over them. Some were vicious and crooked, but they were as near to the movies as you get. So you sat with them, listening to their lies and schemes, and you saw Hollywood with their eyes. An overcrowded brothel, a merry-go-round with beds for horses. Next photo, bubble burst. Hope Holiday says that with her boyfriend outside the dressing room door, Lewis began talking graphically and masturbating in front of her. And in this photo, she is shown leaning against a door, wearing sunglasses, holding a purse, and blowing a bubble with bubble gum. Decades later, the studio system is gone, but as hashtag MeToo proved, justice can still be elusive. Bill Cosby, the first high-profile star to be convicted of sexual assault, has already been released from prison after his conviction was overturned. Roman Polanski is still making movies, and Harvey Weinstein was brought down only after decades of rumors by a cavalcade of more than 80 women. The allegations against Lewis are both devastating. He's said to have terrorized and traumatized women, thwarting their paths and potential in the process, and devastatingly common. These accusations aren't actionable. Lewis died in 2017, lauded in the New York Times as a defining figure of American entertainment. But these women's stories, spanning from 1960 to 1968, illuminate how one man ran rampant at Paramount. Renee Taylor was a comic in New York in the 1960s when she met Lewis on The Tonight Show starring Jack Parr. Lewis complimented the Bronx-born performer and told her to look him up if she made it to Hollywood. She flew to L.A. that night and camped out at Paramount. When Lewis arrived at the studio, Taylor was waiting and asked Lewis for a part in his new film, which happened to be 1961's The Errand Boy. When Lewis said he didn't have a part available, Taylor replied, "I've seen your movies. Tear out four pages and write new ones." Lewis handed her a script so she could rip the pages out herself and got the fearless 28-year-old a meeting with the Paramount brass. Any high the comic was riding, however, was punctured by the executive's first question, "Are you one of Jerry's girls?" Taylor, now 88, recalls trying to explain, no, he saw me on television, and he wrote this part for me." Of course, they didn't believe me. They said, "Well, how big is your pussy? Jerry has a salami, and we'll use it on a girl." They thought it was very funny, and were boasting. I thought it was so gross. It was hard to laugh at Jerry's jokes after that. Ultimately, Taylor, who went on to be an actor and Oscar-nominated writer, adds, "It actually was a good thing that the executives boasted about him, because it gave me warning to be on my guard. I tend to be too trusting." Holiday had every reason to trust Lewis. She met the comedian through her father, a theater executive in New York, when she was 13, and considered Lewis family. The year after Holiday's breakthrough in Billy Wilder's film The Apartment, Lewis offered her a part in The Ladies' Man, a 1961 movie co-written by Lewis that required him to be surrounded by young, beautiful co-stars. "The first day we were working," he said, "can you come to the dressing room afterward? I want to discuss what we're going to shoot tomorrow," Holiday says. "I go into this garish dressing room with red wallpaper and gold furniture, and I sit down and he presses a button, locks me in the dressing room with him. Then he starts to talk to me. 'You know, you could be very attractive, but you wear pants all the time. I have never seen you in a skirt. You have nice legs and you've got good boobs.' Then he starts to talk to me about sex." Sick to her stomach, Holiday told Lewis that her boyfriend was waiting outside. But that didn't stop Lewis. "He starts to talk dirty to me, and as he's talking, the pants open, and the ugly thing came out, and he starts to jerk off," Holiday says. "I was frightened. I just sat there, and I wanted to leave so badly." The following day on set, the script called for Holiday's character to slap Lewis's. "I hit him so hard that I spun around, and I didn't mean to," says Holiday. After a beat, she admits, "Maybe down deep I did, but he walked off the set and sulked for an hour. He said I did it on purpose." Production halted because Lewis, in addition to being the star, was also directing. "He finally came back and didn't talk to me," says the actor. "He never spoke to me again." The experience made Holiday depressed and eventually hostile. One evening, after wrapping her scenes for the day, she borrowed a mink to go to the premiere of the Paul Newman film Exodus. She was excitedly heading off set when her director announced a schedule change. There was suddenly another scene for her to shoot. Holiday couldn't mute herself anymore. "Who do you have to F to get off this picture?" she cracked, in a line arguably better than any in the film. Holiday's friends suggested reporting Lewis to the Screen Actors Guild, but she was scared he would take further action, even cutting her from the film completely. He was very big at Paramount. "I was under contract to him and to Paramount, and I didn't want to shake the boat. You know, I figured I'll just keep my mouth shut." In 1963, Jill St. John starred with Frank Sinatra in Come Blow Your Horn, a comedic role that would earn her a Golden Globe nomination. Afterward, she was vocal in interviews about wanting to be taken seriously as a comedic actor. Be careful what you wish for. That same year, the future Bond girl appeared in Who's Minding the Store, playing Lewis's Randy love interest, a woman so overcome with passion for the comic that, after making him a home-cooked meal in full makeup and a figure-hugging ensemble, she demands sex. "Be fresh with me now, Norman," makes out with him, tells him, "You have such sexy lips," and begins to undress him. Today, St. John chooses not to speak ill of the dead, but she's not going to lie for them either. While not addressing sexual harassment specifically, she writes in a statement to Vanity Fair, "Comedy has always been my favorite medium. I was thrilled to be cast opposite Lewis. Like many, I considered him a comedy genius. Still do. Unfortunately, one should not confuse the artist with the man. Making the film was an entirely unhappy and disappointing experience. Rather than detail my previous bitterness about filming with someone no longer on this planet, and who cannot rebut, I prefer to say that a good time was not had by all." Connie Stevens, who starred with Lewis in 1958's Rockabye Baby and 1966's Way, Way Out, has pleasant memories of her time with the comedian, but caught glimpses of his dark streak, too. "If you didn't go for his joke, or if you didn't respond to him, he could be cruel," says the actor, who recalls female crew members on set suddenly quitting. "I had heard that he was pretty rough on females. He wasn't on me. Consequently, I was the only actress at his funeral." Anna Maria Alberghetti, a soprano prodigy turned Tony-winning actor, recalls hearing that Lewis's wife, Patty, had to be announced every time she arrived at Paramount. "Why would a wife have to be announced?" she wondered. She figured it out pretty quickly. Alberghetti says Lewis came on to her while taping the 1959 TV special The Jazz Singer, but she brushed it off. She agreed to reunite with him for 1960's Cinderfella, even though she had to commute to Los Angeles from Las Vegas, where she was headlining multiple shows a week. This time around, Lewis was more aggressive. He called meetings after filming had wrapped for the day and dismissed everyone but her. Exhausted, she had to fend off his advances. "He tried very hard," she says. "He came on to me constantly. I would say to him, Jerry, I'm seeing someone. You've got the wrong chick." Alberghetti emerged unscathed. She suspects it's because by the time she met Lewis, she had already established herself as a star, having performed at Carnegie Hall and co-starred with Bing Crosby. "If this had been my first break in the business, I probably wouldn't have had a choice," she says. There it is. Lainey Kazan had encountered years of sexual harassment and uncomfortable behavior from men when the actor-singer first met Lewis. She never experienced the depths of Lewis's cruelty, but his attitude toward women was plain nonetheless. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones. reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.